I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Last February, in his State of the Union address, President Donald Trump said that his administration would aim to end the HIV epidemic in the United States by 2030. There are more than 31,000 people in Maryland living with HIV. About 19,000 of those patients live in the Baltimore metropolitan area. Can we actually stop transmission of HIV by protecting people from ever acquiring the disease in the first place? The drugs to treat and prevent HIV are expensive. Only a fraction of people who could benefit from new medicines have access, and many people are resistant to even being tested. Today on Midday, my guests are physicians and community advocates on the front lines of HIV prevention and treatment here in Baltimore. Ending AIDS, that's coming up on Midday, right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. In his 2019 State of the Union address, President Trump called for an end to the HIV epidemic in America by the year 2030. In the early days of the HIV/AIDS crisis in the 1980s, a diagnosis of HIV was a death sentence. Over the last 30 years, AIDS has claimed the lives of more than 500,000 people. Now, it's a chronic, treatable condition. Even more promising, medicines have been developed which curb the acquisition of HIV entirely. Today on Midday, a conversation about the viability of ridding the world of AIDS in the next decade. What strategies and treatments are working and what still needs to be accomplished. You can join our conversation on the WIPR Facebook page where we are streaming live. A little later in the program, we'll take your calls and comments. We begin today with Dr. Sebastian Roos. He's the director of the Infectious Diseases Center of Excellence at Chase Brexton Healthcare here in Baltimore. Dr. Roos, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom.
And Dr. Errol Fields, an assistant professor of pediatrics at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. He's also at the Bloomberg School of Public Health and on the faculty of the Leadership Education in Adolescent Health Program. Dr. Fields, welcome to you as well, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
So, Dr. Roos, let me start with you. There's a campaign called U equals U, undetectable equals untransmittable. What does that mean?
That is one of the campaigns that was recently launched internationally. What this stands for is, as you pointed it out, undetectable equals untransmittable, meaning a person that is HIV positive is taking medications regularly and has an undetectable viral load, which is the goal of taking medications, that we can't detect the virus in the blood anymore. Research has found out that these individuals cannot transmit the virus to their sexual partners. There were large studies launched with thousands of acts of sexual intercourse, and there wasn't a single case of transmission of the virus. And so the campaign is dedicated to destigmatize. It's to educate the public that this is the latest evidence that we have and to help allow people live normal and healthy lives in their communities.
And Dr. Fields, your specialty is pediatrics, and that means that your patients, what's the upper end of the age scale of the people you treat?
Yep, so I'm a pediatrician, but also an adolescent medicine subspecialist. So I primarily see patients from age of 12 to 25.
Mm-hmm. And there's this drug called PrEP, P-R-E-P, which stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis. So this is the drug Dr. Roos is talking about people taking. How does this drug work?
So pre-exposure prophylaxis is actually medication for those who are HIV negative. And so those are for individuals who may be at risk for acquiring HIV through sexual behavior or through injection drug use. And actually, the PrEP is a medication that's taken on a daily basis. And by taking it daily, it reduces your risk of acquiring HIV by up to 92%.
And how does it do that? I mean, how does it act as a barrier?
So it's actually an anti-HIV medicine that actually was a component of the what we used to call cocktails that people who are living with HIV would take. So it's actually two medications combined into one pill. And it actually does, without getting into too many biological and cell level details. It basically protects those white blood cells that are infected with HIV, infected by HIV, from being infected by a virus if they become exposed to it.
And make sure I understand right. That's not the drug then that people are taking who already have HIV to reduce their viral load. That's a different drug?
It is one of the drugs that people can take, but they have to take other medication, other drugs along with that medication in order to suppress their viral load.
Mm-hmm. And so, Dr. Roos, the typical patient then who would be put on that kind of regimen with the PrEP plus other medications, what characteristics are you looking for a person who would be a good candidate for this treatment?
Yeah, so we're looking for people that are at high risk of getting in contact with HIV. And as Dr. Fields pointed out, this can be either sexual or by injection drug use. And sometimes they can be relatively clear and relatively easy. So certain criteria that meet the definition of high risk are people who are having frequently changing sexual partners and or sex on an anonymous basis. So those are relatively easy to identify and then recommend PrEP to them. But there's also a little bit of a gray area, because some studies have shown that a not insignificant proportion of people who are getting infected with HIV are getting infected through their main partner, so essentially on a so-called passive route, and so identifying those people is a little bit more tricky, and that requires really in-depth conversation.
And Dr. Fields, the conversations that you have with your patients, what is the best way to approach the topic of sex education, essentially, for young people? How should we orient ourselves when we're talking to young people about this?
That's a great question. I mean, I think as a physician and as a provider, we spend a lot of time just being as open and inclusive as possible in terms of understanding people's behavior, their identity, their questions they may be having. I'm dealing with people who are fairly young and who are new to sexual behavior in general. And so oftentimes there's lots of questions, curiosity, things that they may not be as comfortable talking about. So it's my job as a provider to be very open to whatever it is that they have to tell me. And to be very open in the questions that I'm asking of them.
And non-judgmental.
Exactly, non-judgmental.
I mean, you just really need to know what's going on.
Right.
Whether or not it's something you may even approve of or disapprove of in your own
Right, my approval has no input whatsoever.
Yeah.
And that's the message I try to portray to them.
Is that difficult to get your patients to open up and to be candid and to really give you a full picture of what's going on? Because without that full picture, you're not going to be able to treat them effectively.
It's not been difficult for me and for our practice. I think because we focus very much on being non-judgmental, being a safe and open space for patients to be able to talk about things that concern them. We are an adolescent medicine program that's adolescent-centered but family-involved. So we recognize oftentimes adolescents are not comfortable talking about some issues in front of their parents. And so we provide them with opportunities to do that in a safe space, but also recognizing that parents are parents and want to be aware of what's happening with their kids. And so we have a nice sort of dialogue with both patient and parents before we split them up and put them into separate spaces so that we can reassure parents that we're not about keeping secrets, and we can reassure kids that we're about being open and accepting to them.
Yeah, but that's a thin tightrope to walk. Yeah,
it is.
Good for
it
you.
Is.
Dr. Roos, should we be expanding our vocabulary about what it means to talk about safe sex? Safe sex has been one of those sort of rhetorical terms that's been out there in the ozone layer for a long time. But has it changed because HIV is now treatable? It's a chronic condition. It's no longer a death sentence. I mean, do we need to change our notion of what safe sexual behavior constitutes?
Absolutely. With safe sex, historically, most people are talking about sex without condom, but talking about safe sex, that's actually relatively nonspecific. There are a lot of components that can fall into this. And it's important to be specific of what do you mean. Do you mean condomless sex, or do you mean sex with under the influence of drugs or alcohol, or do you mean something else by it? So I think it's important to be very specific about that, especially in the era of PrEP and where we have other preventative measurements now besides condoms.
Is the fact, Dr. Fields, that there are these medications, is it changing the behavior of young people in particular when it comes to sex? I mean, their antecedents, you know, particularly in the LGBTQ community of, you know, in the 1980s and 1990s, didn't have that option.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a death sentence. Now there are options. Are you finding that behaviorally people are making adjustments?
So I'm not finding that adolescents are becoming riskier in their behaviors. And I actually try to stay away from the term risky sex or high risk and talk more about potential for acquisition of HIV. Certainly the studies that were done in adolescents didn't show any increased risk behavior. So risk compensation is a term that's oftentimes used. Didn't show any increase in risk behavior when PrEP was added to their prevention regimen. Who's to say that whether or not that's going to change? But certainly we had the similar arguments around birth control 30 years ago, 40 years ago, when birth control was introduced, about that increasing risk behavior. But I think it's more important to focus on, this is another tool, another prevention tool that youth can use to reduce their risk of HIV, and we can kind of incorporate that into other strategies that are also important for reducing risk.
And Dr. Ruse, you're at the Chase Braxton Brexton Center, which traditionally has a large LGBTQ population of patients. What are the barriers that you're finding when it comes to communicating with your clients?
You mean specifically when the client is already in the office?
Yeah.
I personally don't find many barriers because, again, we're trying to create we are creating an environment that is very open, that is judgment-free. I've certainly had patients in the office where I got the feeling they were holding back or they were starting to feed me with answers that they think I was looking for. And then I was like, okay, let's stop this conversation right here. I'm not judging you. I'm asking these questions to really get a better idea of who you are, what are we dealing with, and how I can help you. There's absolutely no judgment here. And I think with this attitude, it's very easy for patients to open up.
The PrEP medication, for example, needs to be taken daily, right? Is that difficult? I mean, a lot of times young people have a difficult time doing anything on a regular regimen basis.
So yes and no. For a lot of people who are actively coming into the office and seeking advice on PrEP and are asking for PrEP to be prescribed to them, they're highly motivated. And so I think this is kind of a self-selected community that is very adherent to their medication regimen. That having said, we certainly have noted that certain people are not picking up their medications on a regular basis. And then it is up to us to hold a conversation with them.
And Dr. Fields, I understand that on the horizon of a fairly short horizon, there's a potential for an injectable drug that would last up to 6 weeks. What are the prospects of that becoming available?
Yeah, so I'm not familiar with all the details. Certainly, there are injectable PrEP regimens that are sort of being studied now for effectiveness and for safety. And so I believe that those will be coming on the market once they become approved for safety and the FDA approves those. But I can't give you an exact timeline on that. But that would certainly be a huge help because in the adolescent world, we certainly have a big challenge with adherence, even among those individuals who sort of come to us for PrEP and are motivated. I think adherence in general is hard for all of us, but particularly for adolescents who may not have had the need to take a medication on a regular basis for a long period of time. So certainly it's a barrier, but there are lots of pieces we have and other clinics in the city have in place to support their adherence.
And Dr. Ruse, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released a report not long ago talking about ending the HIV epidemic. I mean, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, that was an unthinkable thing. But now it is a reasonable aspiration. I mean, are you confident that, in 10, 11 years, we will no longer have the scourge of AIDS?
I am very confident, and actually one of the benefits that we have is that the director of the CDC is a man who is very experienced with taking care of HIV or treating HIV. Dr. Redfield has been working in Baltimore at University of Maryland for years, so I'm very confident in the plan that he has proposed. And I think the two key components in here are that the CDC has looked into where do most infections occur. The goal of the 2030 approach is not to completely eliminate HIV or bring it down to zero. It is to cut the rate of new infections by 90%. And so when the CDC has looked into how and where do new infections occur, they have seen that in 50 counties in the United States, and just for reference, there are over 3,000 counties in the U.S., in 50 counties, over 50% of the new infections occur. So the rates of new infections are very geographically focused. And then within these geographic areas, they're also also demographically focused. There are higher rates of new infections among men who have sex with men. There are higher rates of infections among African Americans and the Latino population. And then there are higher rates of new infections, especially about among young MSM. So with all this data and with this knowledge, there is a good opportunity that we have now to achieve that goal in 10 years.
And Dr. Fields, how about you? What's your confidence and optimism level?
I'm fairly optimistic as well. I think it's really important, as Dr. Ruse mentioned, to be very mindful of those demographic disparities that exist. Those demographic disparities are not new, and they certainly existed for a long time when it comes to HIV in general and as well as other health disparities. And so formulating a plan that's really going to be specific to those populations in a culturally competent way, in a way that's not going to further stigmatize those groups, is going to be a really important part of that plan. And from what I've seen so far, those things are being considered, but we have to be really careful when we're talking about those populations.
Because as of now, it seems that the transmission rates of HIV are still pretty stubborn. They're still pretty high, right?
Yeah, right.
So reducing them by 90% is a big goal.
Yeah, they've been high, but they've been stable and they've been declining in some groups. But in those groups that are at most at risk, they're not. They're either increasing or they're disproportionately higher in those other groups.
Dr. Errol Field is an assistant professor of pediatrics at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. He's also at the Bloomberg School of Public Health, and he serves on the faculty of the Leadership, Education, and Adolescent Health Program. Dr. Sebastian Ruse is the director of Infectious Diseases Center of Excellence, at the Chase Brexton Healthcare. Thank you both. I very much appreciate it. We need to let you guys get out of here so you can get to clinic and help some people. All right.
Thank you very much.
You've been very helpful to us. Thank you so much. Coming up after a quick break, we'll have more perspectives on the battle against HIV/AIDS. Dr. Kathleen Page of Centro Sol, an advocacy organization for the Latinx community, Mimi Demesiou, the executive director of the Pride Center here in Maryland, and Dr. Adina Greenbaum, an assistant commissioner at the Baltimore City Health Department, will join me here in Studio A. You are welcome to join us as well. Our phone number here, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are also streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, Kalila Harris joins me to speak about the Washington Post op-ed that she co-authored on behalf of people of color who worked in the Obama administration to push back against President Trump's divisive rhetoric. Ms. Harris will also talk about new strategies for public education being promoted by the Center for American Progress, where she's the managing director of their K-12 education policy team. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review The Merry Wives of Windsor at the Baltimore Shakespeare Factory. That's coming up tomorrow here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about ending the HIV epidemic by the year 2030. So now we get a take from people rising to the challenge here in Baltimore. Joining me here in Studio A, Dr. Kathleen Page is an associate professor in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and a co-director of Centro Sol, an advocacy group for the Latinx community. Dr. Page, it's good to meet you.
Thank you. Welcome.
And Dr. Adina Greenbaum is an assistant commissioner of the Bureau of Clinical Services at the Baltimore City Health Department. Dr. Greenbaum, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And joining us on the phone, Mimi Demesiou is the executive director of the Pride Center of Maryland, which advocates on behalf of sexual and gender minorities in Baltimore and Central Maryland. She joins us on the line. Ms. Demesiou, nice to see you. Forgive me, I think I mispronounced your name the first time.
No, it's fine. Thank you for having me.
And listeners, if you'd like to join us, we're at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To drop us a tweet, it's @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, always highly encouraged, @TomHallWYPR. And we are also streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Dr. Greenbaum, what's the scope of the problem of HIV infection and transmission rates here in the city of Baltimore and the Baltimore region?
Well, the issue of HIV and really overall sexual health and wellness, including other sexually transmitted diseases as well, is a large public health priority here. So part of the story is a success story. We've seen decreasing numbers of new infections of HIV over the last 10 or so years in the Baltimore area, and we're very proud of that and very encouraged by that. But it still remains a large problem. We have many people, thousands of people in the city, over 12,000 people living with HIV in the city. And even though we have seen decreasing rates of new infections, those improvements have been unequal over various groups here in the city. We're seeing disparities in different age groups, in different racial and ethnic groups, between genders. So we are still seeing a lot of disparities in HIV across the city. So it remains a large public health priority.
And overall in the state of Maryland, as I understand it, it's some 31, 32,000 cases of HIV, people living with HIV. That's a rough estimate. But the large majority of those are here in the city.
That's correct.
Yeah. And Dr. Page, you work with the Latinos and Latina community here in Baltimore. Are there, in our first segment, the two doctors we had, alluded to specific challenges in minority communities. What are some of those challenges from your perspective?
Yeah, there are several challenges. Some of it depends on affect immigrants in particular and also not immigrants. So in my clinic, a lot of the patients I see are immigrants. And so the biggest challenges that I see in this community are, number one, stigma. Unfortunately, this disease is still very stigmatized in the Latino community. Many patients have had experiences that have been negative in their country of origin and are having difficulties dealing with this diagnosis here. And then language can be a real barrier because accessing services can be difficult if you don't speak the language well. The other one is access to care in general. So many people, many Latinx who live here in Baltimore do not have access to health insurance in the same way that other people do. And by not having access to health insurance, they may not know where they can be tested, where they can get treatment. So I would say that those are big challenges and that they don't only impact the immigrant community because some of these perceptions and beliefs affect everyone. And so when immigrants feel targeted in certain ways, those who are not immigrants but are also part of this community may feel that that applies to everyone.
And Mimi Demasiou, at the Pride Center of Maryland, your approach tends to be kind of holistic. You're not just talking about medical interventions. You're talking about making a range of social services accessible to the LGBTQ community. Is that right?
Well, actually, yes and no. So we do provide peer navigators to allow wraparound services because, if folks are having issues with access to healthcare or access to housing or work, they're not going to be likely to take control of their healthcare as easily, right? So we will provide those types of services. But in addition to that, considering that the high numbers are disproportionately concentrated in the African-American community, we also take an approach leading with critical thinking and cultural affirmation, which is something that actually Dr. Fiamanago spearheaded, and I think that it's been accepted practice also through the CDC, where we understand that these numbers, in addition to other health disparities, are probably more symptomatic of other issues. And so we try to not lead with the sexual and gender with that approach because those types of things end up further alienating the Black community, and we're not going to be able to actually access folks in greater numers if we take a different approach, which is trying to really dismantle the negative effects of living in a society that has excessive anti-Black messaging, and systemic racism, which is probably has resulted in all of these other disparities. So that's another approach that we're finding a lot of good results in accessing the Black community.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Greenbaum, in terms of transmission, the two very common ways of transmitting HIV are through sexual activity and intravenous drug use. Can you give me an idea of which of those two methods of transmission are the greater problem? Are they kind of equal? Is one greatly outweigh the other?
So that has changed over time. So many years ago, when the epidemic, when the HIV epidemic was really at its height in Baltimore, and we were seeing upwards of 800 to 900 new cases of HIV diagnosed a year, injection drug use was really the driving force behind new transmissions in the city. And a lot of improvements that we've seen in decreasing new cases of HIV in Baltimore have been because of decreasing that transmission between injection drug users and being able to promote programs such just syringe exchange and risk reduction services surrounding drug use to decrease transmission there. So now most of the cases that we're seeing are through sexual exposure. So whether it's same gender-loving men or men who have sex with men, the transmission there and heterosexual transmission of HIV remains a significant contribution to new cases as well.
Dr. Dina Greenbaum is the Assistant Commissioner of the Bureau of Clinical Services for the Baltimore City Health Department. She's here in Studio A, along with Dr. Kathleen Page, an associate professor in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. She's also the co-director of Centro Sol here in Baltimore. Mimi Demisiu joins us on the phone. She's the executive director at the Pride Center of Maryland. We will take your phone calls and comments at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. You're welcome to ping us there as well. So, Dr. Page, when a patient comes to you and learns of a diagnosis of HIV, what's that first conversation like between you and that patient at that very vulnerable, scary moment for that person?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I think the way that you phrase it, vulnerable and scary, is how many people really feel. And we know in medicine that when people are feeling that way, they're not going to hear a lot. So sometimes we as physicians tend to talk a lot when we make a new diagnosis. But the reality is patients don't hear a lot because they may be sort of processing and a little bit in shock. The main message that I want to give people when they come have a new diagnosis is a message of hope. I just want them to leave my office knowing that there is treatment and that the treatment is really effective. And in fact, I want them to leave my office with the treatment in hand. So what I try to do as much as possible is tell them, look, acknowledge their feelings. We will have many conversations about this. We will have, I'm happy to help you in your conversations with your loved ones if you want to have them, etc. But right now, let's figure out on what can be done now. And the thing that we can do now is give you a treatment. Generally, it's really one pill without lots of side effects that you can take home today and start taking every day. And then I'll see you in a couple of weeks and see how you're doing. And that actually has been a change from a few years ago, when a change in guidelines where, previously, for many reasons, but partly because the medicines were much more toxic, and we had not learned that treating HIV as early as possible is the best way to prevent complications. We used to not do that. And so we used to tell patients, well, you have this diagnosis, we'll help you through it, but we may treat you in 2 or 3 years, which was not particularly satisfying for either the clinician or the patient. The fact that we have these tools now that are quite, easy to take, they don't have a lot of side effects, and work, give something very tangible and give people a lot of hope.
And Dr. Greenbaum, there is a stigma about even being tested, right? I mean, that's a challenge to convince people that it's in their best interest, and certainly as a public health issue, in everybody's best interest, to be tested if you're even remotely at risk of acquiring HIV.
Yes, the stigma surrounding HIV is one of the largest problems that we have in terms of getting closer to our goals of reducing new infections. Just the stigma associated with getting tested, with having HIV, with seeking care for it, with being able to talk about it openly is a huge challenge that we face. So we're really trying through multiple ways to really address the stigma associated with HIV. One way is doing just what we're doing today, is just talking about it, normalizing it as a health issue, just like any other health condition, and encouraging people to talk about it openly. Something else that we're doing at the Baltimore City Health Department is trying to increase the campaigns and the messaging that we have around the stigma associated with HIV. So right now we have a campaign called People Who Look Like Me, promoting the fact that people from all walks of life, all different sorts of people, are affected by HIV in one way or another. And it really does not, HIV does not affect just one type of person.
And Mimi Demisieux, what's your experience when you've had conversations and you're advocating for people, for example, who are just coming to terms with their status vis-a-vis HIV?
So there's a lot of medical mistrust that's also playing into folks not wanting to get on these meds, either to treat it or to stay negative. That's something that's happening. In addition to everything else folks have already mentioned, that's something that we're finding, and that's difficult, right? Because there's this history that you have to first combat, and trying to get folks to be in a position to want to take agency over their health.
And Dr. Page, we talked in the first segment with Dr. Roos about how the occurrence of HIV transmission tends to be clustered. Of the 3,000 counties in the United States, 50 of them are where most of these transmissions are taking place. How does Baltimore stack up in that particular metric? Are we one of those 50 places?
Yes, we are. That means that there is work to be done. As Dr. Greenbaum mentioned, there really has been a lot of improvements throughout the country and in the city as well. But there's really a lot of work to be done. And if you look at both Baltimore and the other hotspots, what we call hotspots areas in the country that have high rates of transmissions, they're not only concentrated in geographic areas, but also in areas of poverty where there are many other issues that are happening that need to be addressed together, because it's very, very difficult to address HIV without thinking about all the other what we call social determinants, whether it's poverty, housing, substance use disorder, and other things that are really affecting people's life and help, creating barriers to the elimination of HIV.
And I've actually read some reporting that says that there is a certain amount of reluctance on the part of clinicians to engage patients in this way. Obviously, this isn't going to be the case in your clinic because this is what you do. This is your bread and butter. But clinicians in other clinical settings are even in some cases reluctant to prescribe these PrEP drugs that can be literally life-saving. What's going on with that?
I think what's happening there is that physicians, there's certainly a little bit of inertia in terms of adopting anything new in medicine. And there's always the those that are early adopters and those that are waiting a little bit more. Historically, HIV had been an area of treatment that was specialized with infectious, primarily by infectious, delivered by infectious disease specialists. That's certainly, that is not the case now because the treatments have really been simplified in a way that that any primary care and internal medicine physician could do. But there's a learning curve, and PrEP prevention really absolutely is something that is, for it to be effective, needs to be in the hands of the primary care providers. Because if we leave it to infectious disease people, we don't see the people who are not infected. We generally see the people who are already infected. And so the people who are not infected and at risk, they're going to the primary care providers. They're going to the STD clinics. They're going to places where it's absolutely essential that we have providers that are able to identify those at risk and treat them.
And Dr. Greenbaum, before we take a quick break, STIs in general are on the rise. There's an estimate from the New York Times. There's a OBGYN doctor who wrote a piece in the Times a week or so ago. 50% of sexually active people will have at least one STI by the age of 25. The most common is the HPV virus. So it's not just AIDS that is a problem, but incidences of gonorrhea, syphilis are not going away by any means. So is HIV sort of clumped into this whole, larger rubric of STIs? And does that change the dynamic on that in any way?
You're absolutely right that we're seeing rates of other sexually transmitted infections, including chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis, increase nationwide. And in Baltimore, the trends mirror that. And we have very high rates of chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis here, and especially congenital syphilis, where syphilis is passed from a pregnant woman onto her child, which can be very dangerous to the baby. Rates are high here. And we're continuing to try to increase the services and the programming and the prevention methods we have to address all of these issues. And it's important in talking about HIV, as Dr. Page mentioned, to be talking about sexual health and wellness all together. We're not just talking about any one of these in a vacuum, but they're all related to one another. And it's important to have an overall picture of sexual health to address all of them.
How about congenital transmission of HIV from pregnant women to their babies? Has that gone down? We talked about, you know, sharing syringes or, you know, sexual behavior. But what about babies being born infected with HIV?
So that is a success story that we've seen in Maryland, where we have very low rates of congenital HIV transmission, and it's continual work. Once you reach that level that you're going for and seen very low levels of transmission there, it doesn't mean you can stop the work. It means you need to continue what you're doing in order to have gotten there. So we continue to emphasize messaging both to young women, to pregnant women, and to providers. That it's important to test if a woman is considering getting pregnant or during pregnancy, and important to have a high level of awareness around that, because if we all of a sudden stop paying attention to it, then the concern is that we would see an increase again.
Yeah, it's kind of whack-a-mole, isn't it? Yeah. Dr. Adina Greenbaum is the Assistant Commissioner of the Bureau of Clinical Services for the Baltimore City Health Department. Dr. Kathleen Page is an Associate Professor in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. She's a co-director of Centro Sol here in Baltimore, and Mimi Demesiou is the executive director at the Pride Center of Maryland. We'll have more on the prospect of ending the HIV/AIDS epidemic after a quick break. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. To drop us an email, midday@wypr.org. To tweet us, it's @MiddayWYPR. To tweet me, it's @TomHallWYPR. And you can also ping us on the WYPR Facebook page, where we are streaming live from Studio A. Stick around.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, we're talking about ending HIV/AIDS by the year 2030, a stated goal of the Trump administration. And joining me here in Studio A, Dr. Kathleen Page. She's a co-director of Centro Sol, an advocacy organization for the Latinx community here in Baltimore. Dr. Page is an associate professor in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. And Dr. Adina Greenbaum, she's the assistant commissioner of the Bureau of Clinical Services at the Baltimore City Health Department. Joining us on the line is Mimi Demesiou. She's the executive director of the Pride Center of Maryland. That's an organization that advocates for sexual and gender minorities in Baltimore City and throughout Central Maryland. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. And we are also streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. We have been pinged on the WYPR Facebook page by Mary Lynn, who asks, are Baltimore schools able to provide comprehensive health education sessions to students, including primary prevention of STDs? Dr. Greenbaum?
There is a sexual health curriculum in Baltimore City Schools that the Baltimore City Health Department helps collaborate on to help ensure that all the prevention messaging focused on sexual health and wellness, which includes family planning, information about birth control, information about STDs and HIV, are present in the schools. There's also school-based health centers in the schools where students can access testing for STDs and other referral services for sexual health.
I know for many months we spoke with Dr. Lena Nguyen, the former health commissioner here in the city of Baltimore, who was very happy with the progress that's been made about teen pregnancy, unmarried, unwanted in many instances, pregnancy. So there's progress there, and that, of course, is directly related to health and sex education. Mimi Demesiou, in your work at the Pride Center, when you have conversations with people who are reluctant to be tested, who are reluctant to, you know, seek help in this regard, what are those conversations like? What is the pitch that you make to folks who may be reluctant to enter into the system?
There isn't really a pitch. The thing that we try to do is to really, you know, identify what the other issues are. Typically, the reluctancy either comes from, you know, not having a place to live or not having access to health care or not having access to funds or maybe, and also sometimes folks are, you know, don't want to just come in for HIV or STI testing. We have to create different types of programming that feeds, I guess, you know, to feed your soul. Like if there's going to be a Vogue night or some sort of movie night or something that's more fun or socially fulfilling, folks will come in, and when they are in, then they'll take the time to either, you know, seek free legal services and along those lines, you know, get an HIV test or talk to a case manager to get linked to medical care.
And again, it just seems to me that the relationships that you develop and cultivate with each of the folks that you're working with are really important. The trust and credibility has to be there primarily to begin with before any progress can be made in a number of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there was some sort of a report that came out from the health department that found that a lot of times folks were also reluctant to come in and speak to peer navigators if they felt that, you know, those peer navigators wouldn't be trustworthy, or if they were somehow leading lives that looked even riskier than theirs. So we have to make sure that that our folks at our center, you know, can foster that trust by not simply, you know, maintaining confidentiality, but also being community advocates even outside of work. And sometimes that could be a lot of pressure for our employees, but that's the role you end up having to take when you're working in this line of work.
That's Mimi Demesiou. She's the executive director of the Pride Center of Maryland. Dr. Kathleen Page is at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. She's a co-director of Central Soul. And Dr. Dina Greenbaum is with the Baltimore City Health Department. I'm Tom Hall. We're talking about ending HIV/AIDS by the year 2030. Our number here, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To tweet us, it's @MiddayWYPR. And you can also ping us on the WYPR Facebook page. Dr. Page, the possibility of home testing, I understand, is becoming more prevalent. Tell us how that works and how you think that will affect people's capacity to be tested and to be treated.
So home testing is, for some people, is a great option because it gives them ownership over this. You can actually buy home testing kits at Walgreens or a CVS. There are also programs through health departments in various areas of the country where you can obtain self-testing kits. And again, I think it is just another tool for patients. It's not for everyone. Some people really would feel uncomfortable doing the test on their own, without having someone to discuss the results with. But for some patients, it really gives them the flexibility of not having to go to a clinic, of having that reassurance. Some patients, depending on their risk, may want to test every so often, every 3 to 6 months, and they don't have to make a special appointment, take time off work, et cetera, to do that. So I do think in anything in clinical medicine, we want to give patients as many options as they have, so that they can do what fits their schedule, preference, et cetera, best.
Because there are a number of home testing opportunities available for people for a number of diseases. I know colorectal cancer can now be tested at home. As a physician, are you confident that the efficacy of the home testing for HIV is reliable?
The critical thing with home testing, whether it's HIV or anything else, is that then there's a clear pathway to getting a confirmatory test. So in HIV, we always get a confirmatory test. So that first test is not the one all be all. You have to get a confirmatory test. And clearly, if that test comes back positive, there needs to be access to clinical care that's really fully accessible. So I would be very uncomfortable with a test, for example, that's available, but if you get a positive, unless you have insurance and can pay the copays, et cetera, you can't see anyone. That is not the case for HIV. HIV is a disease that, thankfully, we have basically public and private services for everyone. So yes, I'm confident that the tests are good, but I do think that there needs to be a pathway, and especially if the test is positive, they need to be discussed with a clinician and confirmed.
And Dr. Greenbaum, in terms of accessibility, it's one thing, you know, to be able to get to a clinic, you know, easily and all that, but the other thing is cost. The company that makes this PrEP drug, which is called, is it Truvada or Truvada?
Truvada.
The company is called Gilead, and it charges between $1,600 and $2,000 a month for a supply of the pill. And again, this is a medication that has to be taken every day. This drug was developed with grants from the U.S. government that, you know, totaled $50 million, something like that. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation chipped in another $17 million. Yet this company seems to have a monopoly on Truvada, and it's very expensive. They made $3 billion selling this drug last year. How do we fix this? The inaccessibility because of cost dilemma.
That's certainly a very high priority at the health department, is how do we increase access to PrEP so that everybody who could benefit from it and who's interested in it does have access to it, and that cost is not one of the barriers. So there's a few different things that we have now, and then other things that we're planning on working on for the future. So currently, Gilead does have two assistance programs where people who are uninsured or underinsured can receive financial assistance in order to be on PrEP and can have access to PrEP. There's also networks of clinics that we have around the city that help provide access to PrEP and help make sure that patients have insurance, and if not, help them sign up for insurance.
And Dr. Page, in the United Kingdom, there was a 17% drop in the number of new diagnoses of HIV last year. That declined from 5,200 cases to 4,300 cases in 2017, actually. Numbers have been reduced by more than a quarter since 2015. They are making huge progress. Are we doing here in the United States and in Baltimore specifically, are we doing the kinds of things that they're doing in the UK? And do you expect we'll have the same kinds of good results?
We are certainly working very hard, and there are many of the basic core principles in terms of HIV prevention that both the Baltimore City Health Department and the CDC is recommending, and those include access, diagnosis, treatment, virologic suppression, as we spoke about before, which can then eliminate transmission, and access to PrEP and treatment. There are big differences, though, between the UK health system on ours. The first one that comes to mind is that they are a nationalized health system. And so in some ways, that really allows for sort of broad implementation of programs in a different way that happens in the U.S., where the health system is fairly, you know, compartmentalized. It depends if you're going to a private provider, if you're not, et cetera, et cetera. So certainly a nationalized health system, which is, I'm not saying that I'm advocating for that, but that provides a structure that allows for these large national type interventions to happen, for data to be gathered in a very consistent way. And really it's the issue of access. And while this may not be as an important issue in Maryland, which is an ACA expansion state, the truth is that expansion of the Affordable Care Act or not really impacts access to care in general, and it also impacts access to HIV care. So for patients who don't have access to insurance, really getting to PrEP, getting to HIV treatment and testing is hard.
Yeah, a long-standing problem that affects patients of all sorts of with all sorts of maladies. Dr. Kathleen Page from the Division of Infectious Diseases at Johns Hopkins Medicine, the co-director of Central Seoul, Dr. Adina Greenbaum from the Baltimore City Health Department, and Mimi Demesiou, the executive director of the Pride Center of Maryland. Thanks to all of you. I very much appreciate your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
That's it for us today. Thanks to Rob Velasquez for his help with today's show. Coming up tomorrow, Kalila Harris will join us to speak about the Washington Post op-ed that she co-authored, which was signed by nearly 150 black staffers in the Obama administration about President Trump's divisive rhetoric. She's also the managing director of the Center for American Progress's K-12 education policy team. So we'll talk about a new education policy agenda that the center released earlier this month. Plus, the Merry Wives of Windsor is at the Baltimore Shakespeare Factory. We'll have a review with J. Wynn Russick. Lunch today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. More information on the web at dangerouspiesbulk.com. I'm Tom Hall. Here and Now is coming up next after the news at the top of the hour. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.